KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset. Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we'll drop into the Russian River counting salmon to see how healthy the population is.
We snorkel in as little as like a couple inches of water sometimes to get numbers and get eyes on the fish.
Then we climb up the riverbank and hear from a grape grower trying to create a better habitat for the fish in her backyard.
I think the fish need the water more than the grapes do. Sacrilege, though, that is in wine country.
And we'll head back down and over to Napa to hear how a mistake led to a legendary dish and meet the man still making it.
Un pizzicone di qui, a pizzicone di lì, a pinch here, a pinch there.
Stay tuned, Cross Currents is next. Every July and August, fish biologists across California suction snorkel masks onto their faces. With scuba diving flashlights in hand, they crawl, swim, and slither up the tributaries of rivers, the Trinity, the Salmon, the Klamath, the Sacramento, and the Russian, literally counting the number and species of salmon they see to measure the health of the population. This method to monitor the salmon and steelhead populations is effective and low-tech, and it hasn't changed much over the years, but the salmon population in California has changed. KALW's Angela Johnston joined a snorkel survey at a small tributary of the Russian River where the endangered species is struggling to make a comeback.
I'm on Willow Creek up near where the Russian River meets the Pacific Ocean. But no matter where you are in California, these snorkel surveys start in a pretty similar fashion. And it's unlike anything I've ever seen before. Three fish biologists from the group California Sea Grant climb into big black balloon-like suits and hop over fences or scurry down steep riverbanks, whacking away brush to get to the riverbed. They spit in their goggles to stop them from fogging up, check to make sure their field computers and flashlights are working, and prepare themselves for a face full of cold water. Here's Elizabeth Ruiz.
The first pool of the morning is always like a nice wake up.
Then they do what's called the steelhead shuffle.
Okay, here I go.
Mariska Obazinski is the program leader and tells me this is one of her favorite spots to survey.
We're kind of looking upstream into this clear, cold water. There's, you know, a lot of gravel and just huge redwoods all around us. It's really quiet and peaceful, and it's just, you just know, like, when you see this, this is like, if I were a juvenile coho salmon or steelhead, this is where I would want to live, because it's so gorgeous.
Me too. Even if I wasn't a fish, I probably want to live
not
here.
Being a fish,
coho salmon spend their entire first year of life in freshwater streams like these before heading to the sea, where they live for 1 or 2 years. Then they return to the same freshwater spot to lay eggs of their own. Each summer, these biologists also return to count the number of coho salmon and steelhead trout. The data paints a picture of the health of the endangered species and the entire ecosystem. It gets used by other local organizations like the Sonoma County Water Agency and national organizations like Fish and Wildlife to help justify restoration projects. The biologists in their puffy suits may look silly, but their methods are calculated, even the steelhead shuffle. The move looks just as quirky as the name sounds. Mariska describes why Elizabeth moves her feet to the right, to the left, and to the right and left again.
When the water's really shallow, you can't really see the fish in there, so we're just kind of trying to chase them up, and you kind of shuffle your feet to get the fish to move up to a place that you can count them.
And then she crouches down on all fours, lowers her face and body in the water, and starts to pull herself up the stream. Part swimming, part floating, part crawling when the stream gets too shallow. She peers around the roots of redwood trees and the pools that form underneath them with her flashlight, checking to see if any fish are hiding in there. She herds any fish she spots in front of her so she doesn't count the same one twice.
we snorkel in as little as like a couple inches of water sometimes. Like we really can drag ourselves through it to get numbers and get eyes on the fish.
They have to be quick and stealthy and sly.
From above, it just looks like this, you know, tiny little puddle in a way. You know, the creeks are so small right now, but then when you get, you know, when you're looking underwater, it's like, wow, there is a whole nother world under here. You know, there's, you can see insects, you can see different fish.
On shore, we stay quiet and still. We crane our necks and follow Elizabeth as she rounds the bend of the pool. She emerges, dripping wet, looking like a creature from the Black Lagoon. Then she peels off her mask.
No fish. No fish. Okay.
No fish here, echoes Mariska. She types a zero into her tiny orange field computer. And we trek on to the next section. We'll visit about 25 different pools today in the creek. This summer, they'll survey nearly 100 different streams that make up the Russian River. Mariska's been collecting data this way almost 15 years. But since she grew up along a stream in Marin County, she's actually been counting salmon for much longer. When she was a kid, her family would celebrate the return of salmon each fall. The rivers would be practically overflowing with fish.
You know, every winter, like one of the things we would always do together is look for the fish. You know, we'd have the big first rain and you know, we had certain little walks that we'd do along the creeks to go see the fish.
Mariska helped start the Russian River snorkel survey back in 2004. She'd trek up and down streams and not see a single fish. A year later, coho salmon moved from a threatened species to an endangered one. Biologists counted fewer than 10 fish returning to the Russian River to spawn that year. A history of population growth and development along the river is partly to blame, with people logging trees, digging wells, mining gravel, watering grapevines, building dams. That's all really hard on salmon.
For them to complete their life cycle, every piece of the puzzle has to be in good enough shape for them to do that.
So government agencies and nonprofit conservation groups work to save the species, starting a fish hatchery to grow and release more salmon, building a fish ladder to help salmon get over dams, convincing landowners to build rainwater storage systems, and pulling fallen trees into the river to create better salmon habitat.
Many years ago, there was, you know, a lot of effort to, like, clear the streams out of all the wood and, you know, like clear the channels. And now there's like a ton of work to put all this wood back in because it's so important for helping these fish populations recover.
Over time, the numbers from the snorkel surveys can tell biologists where to focus their efforts.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised I haven't fallen in. Yeah, okay. Don't jinx it.
For us, the restored salmon habitat creates a slippery obstacle course as we trek over and under down trees to snorkel more pools further up the river. Some have no fish, like the first pool. Others are more promising.
It's usually a good thing.
You can tell it's good news from the bank when you hear a little peep come out of the snorkel. We start to hear numbers like 2 and 5 fish and 10 fish being yelled back.
In that pool, there were 2 coho yoi, and they were hanging out like right in the middle here in this deep spot, both of them.
Yoi means young of the year, the babies born in 2018. Even though I don't have a mask on, I begin to see some salmon too.
It's like right in the deepest spot, like along that dark leaf edge.
Oh, yeah, right there.
The fish are tiny, no bigger than the length of my pointer finger. Not what you'd expect to see when you picture a salmon. These are just juveniles born here when their parents defeated all odds and laid their eggs here last fall. Mariska says this means the restoration efforts are working. Then she lowers her body and face into maybe 2 inches of water to snorkel. Even with just a trickle of water, these salmon are extremely resilient. It's just enough for them to survive. In Willow Creek, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Let me introduce to you a brand new dance. I know you're gonna love it if you give it one chance. It's not complicated, it's not too hard. Have to be a hip-hop star. See, anyone can do it. All you need is staff. Listen up, peep gang, I'ma show you how. Put your hands to the side. As silly as it seems,
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. One of the main reasons for the decline of the salmon population in the Russian River is the simple fact that humans live along it, work along it, growing marijuana, growing grapes, building their houses. The list goes on. It's a beautiful spot, but in many cases, this development comes at the expense of the salmon population. So part of the solution is working with the people who live right along the water to make a better environment for the fish. KALW's Angela Johnston walked along a small tributary of the Russian River called Grape Creek with a landowner who's working to be a better neighbor for the salmon ever since she saw salmon spawning in her backyard.
When it's happening, I can't get anything done. You know, I have like all these chores to do, and you know, it's just like I just walk up and down the banks of the creek and take video, and then my battery runs out. And you know, I mean, it's like, it's very magical.
So this is my main watching spot.
I'm Sally Weed, and we're in the Dry Creek Valley, which is north of Healdsburg.
This is why we call it Weed Farm People.
Which is north of Santa Rosa.
Very, very weedy.
In Sonoma County.
Oh, wow.
Never saw.
Yeah. Ooh. Can I pick one?
Yeah.
Wow.
Dry Creek. The creek itself is a big tributary of the Russian River watershed. A lot of the tributaries off of Dry Creek are the spawning grounds for the fish that come up and breed here. And it's part of the whole system of redwood trees and salmon and trout and in my case, grape growing as well. I grow Syrah and also a combination of an Italian field blend, sort of, but I just have a total of 5 acres of that, and that abuts the stream, which is Grape Creek. The first time I ever saw a male coho swimming was here, and I just about died.
Really?
So beautiful. Just, you know, red.
Yeah.
Just red and
gnarly birds.
It changed, it changed my life. And it made me, you know, feel like I could understand what is happening here. You know, that this, you know, everything else is just bullshit. I would say the salmon are the fulcrum. You know, that pull all these areas of knowledge and the plans for improvement together. They did a survey here on this part of Grape Creek back in 1998 where they found a spawner. And so the fact that they were finding random coho coming up here to breed kind of put this tiny little tributary in this tiny little canyon into the program, because it's not long. The headwaters are just up at the end of the road, you know. I'll have a question, and then I'll talk to somebody within that group, and they refer me to somebody else, and then it's like, hey, maybe we can do something to improve the spawning grounds in this creek. And one thing leads to another, and, you know, then you're making a plan to build, you know, large wood structures in the stream, of which we have now, I think they put in a total of 10.
Okay, really. So this is for the structure,
yeah.
Then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what are we looking at?
So there's one root wad. There are two root wads that are dug into the bank there. And then there's this one, which you can see there's a little notch cut out. There's a big bolt that goes through there, and that's bolting it to the other redwood logs. And then,
yeah, definitely. Just from what I saw when I went to do the snorkel survey, this looks like a great little habitat.
Where did you guys do the snorkel survey? On Willow?
Yeah, on Willow, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Which was, like, there was still quite a bit of water there, so.
We just didn't have many fish, and you count backwards, and it's like, yeah, because 3 years ago, that was the beginning of the drought, or whatever, it was maybe the peak of the drought. And, you know, any fish that were born here that year, they didn't make it.
But knowing that you have fish, that you have an endangered species in your backyard, how does that influence the way you farm and the way you grow your grapes?
Yeah, I just recently was able to work with the Sonoma Resource Conservation District, and they helped me purchase 5 additional water storage tanks so that I won't be needing to pump water out of the ground.
Do you take water from the creek or is there...
No, I have a well and it goes down into the water table. So I have 3 upstream gauges that measure flow and water temperature on the tributaries to grapes. So they're ephemeral streams. They're not by any means even as substantial as grape. That was some of the first gadgetry we did and monitoring. So I have a meter on my water that flows out to irrigate the vineyard. I don't irrigate the vineyard too much anymore. It's not the priority, but I have it there for certain key times. I do deficit watering. My future plan is to actually make my vineyard a little smaller rather than bigger, because I think the fish need the water more than the grapes do. Sacrilege though that is in wine country.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter. You can reach her at environment@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Tourists to the Napa Valley may visit their favorite exclusive wineries and fine dining restaurants, but locals love a more humble dish.
Malfatti.
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 It's a little spinach and cheese dumpling shaped like a pinky finger and smothered in sauce. And where do you find the most famous malfatti? In the back of a liquor store in the town of Napa. That's where Lisa Morehouse is taking us today for the series California Foodways.
Dad, how many malfattis we got?
At Val's Liquor, there's a large industrial kitchen where the Chitone family's at work.
Tell them to come and bring the container.
At the center of the scene is the patriarch, Clemente Chitone.
I'm still cooking at the age 78.
After moving to Napa from Lake Cuomo, Italy in the 60s, Chitone first worked as a dishwasher, then graduated to potato peeler, then apprentice cook.
The lady that teach me was Mrs. Teresa Tamburelli. She's the one invented the famous pasta called malfatti.
Well, famous in Napa. In the kitchen, Chitone sautés onions, spinach, and a few other ingredients in a saucepan, and puts the mixture through a grinder to combine before adding cheese and eggs. His mentor, Mrs. Tamburelli, always told him no measuring necessary.
Un pizzico in the key, a pizzico in the lee, a pinch here, a pinch there.
His hands are too arthritic to form dumplings, so his daughter Joanne Chitone Gonzalez takes over, pinching off bits of filling.
The malfattis are, they're hand rolled by my mother, by my son, by my own self, by hand. There's no malfatti machine, but they come out very beautiful.
Hey, Bello, how you doing?
In walks Ray Guadagni, a retired judge and lifelong customer.
How you doing, sir? Nice to see you.
Can't complain for an old man.
We meet here and then go to Little Italy, the neighborhood where he grew up and where Napa's malfatti began.
This is your house?
This is my house. We rented for $50 a month.
Whoa!
From the Cavanieros.
That was in the 1950s.
Next door here, there were the Squeecherinis.
Young, single Italian men first arrived in this neighborhood in the 1860s to work on the railroad. San Francisco refugees also settled here.
It was a devastating earthquake to San Francisco in 1906, and that led to a lot of migration here.
For decades, the town of Napa remained blue-collar, with people working in factories and orchards. But when they could, they visited the pride of Little Italy, the Depot Restaurant, opened by Teresa Tamburelli in the 1920s.
A lot of people were poor and didn't have money to go to dinner that often. My dad ran a wrecking yard, and while he was not wealthy, he loved food.
So the family had most Sunday dinners at the Depot, a block from their house. As a little boy, Guadagni fetched what amounted to 1950s takeout there.
My mom would send me to the back door with a pot.
a pot from her own cupboard and a note.
And it would say the ravioli and the malfatti, and they would take it and bring it into the kitchen and
fill up the pot and send little Ray Guadagni back home with dinner. Malfatti was legendary, and its origin story is a little different depending on who you ask. Ray Guadagni, Clemente Cittoni, or other Malfatti lovers around town.
We understood it as being a mistake.
Teresa Tamborelli intended to make ravioli when a visiting baseball team came to town.
Poor Mrs. Tamborelli, she forgot the reservation.
But she ran out of dough.
So lucky she made extra filling of the ravioli.
You had made too much filling, not enough dough. You couldn't fill the ravioli. Oops, what are we going to do? You rolled these little finger-sized rolls.
Like little meatball.
Looked like a little Jimmy Dean sausage or something. And that she served instead of the ravioli.
She made a mistake, so she named it Malfatti.
Meaning it's a mistake or poorly made. People loved it.
Malfatti became as ubiquitous on Napa's Italian restaurant menus as spaghetti and ravioli. Now, it's hard to confirm that Malfatti was born in Napa. Italy's Lombardy region boasts an oblong green gnocchi Malfatti. And in Siena, they make nudi, little balls made of ricotta and sometimes spinach. But there's no doubt that the town of Napa made the Depot restaurant's Malfatti its own. When Teresa Tamborelli retired, Clemente Cittoni became head cook.
He made you feel so welcome.
Ray Guadagni.
He would say, Ramondo, and he would put his arms around me and he would kiss me on the cheeks, and he was hot and sweaty and a wet kiss, and he did it with everybody.
Oh yeah. That was one of my favorite restaurants. Yeah, Depot.
That's Hiro Sone, chef of the high-end Terra restaurant in nearby St. Helena. He found Malfatti totally unique.
I never seen any other part of the United States has Malfatti. You know, we are in Napa. So I want to put on the menu.
And in the restaurant's cookbook, Malfatti with rabbit cacciatore. Sone's wife, pastry chef Lissa Domeni, says Malfatti represents a fast-disappearing working-class Napa, and it should be preserved.
It's going to be tough around here to find the original Napa. And there are going to be very few places because they just get pushed out by property value.
So if this dish is so important and so well-loved, how did the original Napa Malfatti end up in the back of a liquor store? When the Tamborelli family finally sold the Depot restaurant, the new owner wanted Cittoni to keep running the kitchen, but cut corners on the recipes.
I'm sorry, I said, cut down the quality. That's my reputation.
So he quit, and soon the Depot closed for good. When he got an offer to partner with this liquor store in 2008, Cittoni took it. He says he won't live forever, but he hopes Malfatti will.
I hope my daughter Joanne and her family, and they keep going, because otherwise Napa Valley gonna miss a hell of a good dish.
And miss that lesson, that a mistake can become something legendary. In Napa, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That story is part of Lisa's podcast, California Foodways. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, hear the best of Cross Currents anytime by subscribing to the Cross Currents podcast. Do it at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Nina Gensler-Deb, Sarah Harrison, Mary Franklin Harvin, Sarah Kaust, Priscilla Wilson, Beau Walsh, and Eli Wertschafter. Gabe Graben and James Rollins engineered the show. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by 1OAK. He's playing a show with Astu and Noah and the Architects. That's at Red Bay Coffee in Oakland on Thursday night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
I ain't ballin' out the gym, but girl, I got a lot to give.